Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I'm joined today by Sir Michael Fallon, former Defence Secretary, former Conservative MP, geopolitical expert. And Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
We are talking on the eve of the London Defence Conference, which happens next week, which you're taking part in, which I'm the director of, and that's 3 days at King's College London next week, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, on the theme, deterrence, building capacity to counter global threats. Now, there's a lot to unpick, a lot of themes in the conference, but I want to begin by asking you about this 3% campaign that you've been involved in and been helping to lead. And of course, the government recently announced that it was going to 2.5% of UK GDP being spent on defence. But your view, very clearly stated, is that's still not enough.
Yes, that hasn't changed. A stronger defence is a key part of deterrence. These things fit together. And there's no doubt in my mind, given the escalation in threats that we face from Russia and our continent, from the turbulence in the Middle East, from the instability in Indo-Pacific, we simply need to be spending more on our defence. Now, we all committed, as you know, to 2% 10 years ago. Mm. Only half, we met it on my watch, but only half of NATO does 2%. So we need to spend more ourselves on defence, and I think we also need to show the leadership we showed back then, 10 years ago at the NATO summit, by driving the other allies up to spend more, not least because we may be facing a Trump presidency from the autumn. So getting the level of spending up is really important. We're spending 2.2 at the moment. To get to 2.5, it's not a huge ask, but I don't think that's enough. If you go back to the turn of the century under the, when the Blair government started, long before 9/11, long before Crimea or any of these threats or international terrorism, we were spending 2.7%.
Yeah.
Now, the world's a lot more dangerous now, so we need to spend more.
Or if you go back to the last time that the UK was retooling and re-establishing its nuclear deterrent, in the 80s, the UK was spending 5.5%. Now, of course, that was during the era of the Cold War, but it just strikes me as odd that if 2.5% was regarded not that long ago as outlandish, or 2% was deemed OK in 2014, why is it taking people so long to realise that we are going to have to spend 3%, maybe even potentially, if it carries on like this, more? I mean, look at Poland. Poland is spending more than 4%. Why is it taking so long for the penny to drop, do you think?
Yes, not just Poland. You know, the Baltic states are spending more than us now. And these are smaller economies. And, you know, without that legacy of large defence, I don't think politicians, you know, have really woken up the public here to the danger that we're in. We've seen attacks. You know, we've seen attacks in one of our cathedral cities. We've seen what Putin is capable of doing. We've seen international terrorism. And I don't think yet politicians have really, you know, explained to the public that this is a far more dangerous world than it was even 10 years ago, and certainly than 20 years ago. And probably now at its most dangerous since the very height of the Cold War.
So we'll come back to a little later what the 3%, if we get there, what it could be spent on or what it should be spent on. But define the threat for us at the moment as you see it.
Oh, the threat is multiple across the world. The threat is on our own continent, where Putin has made it very clear that he wants to re-assimilate former Soviet Union countries back into their ambit. And therefore, if he's not stopped in Ukraine, if he succeeds in Ukraine, then Moldova is vulnerable, Georgia is vulnerable, the Baltic states perhaps are vulnerable as well. And I think we've learnt to our cost that if you don't deal with this kind of international law breaking very quickly, you pay much, much more later on. And that, by the way, we'll come back to the 2.5-3%. That is actually the argument. You'll pay far more than that if you don't improve your defence now to the point where you actually deter. You will end up having to spend much more. And look at the cost of the war already for us in higher energy prices, higher food prices, and the eventual cost of reconstructing Ukraine. So you've got the threat on our own continent, and then you've got the continuing instability in the Middle East, which affects our trade routes. We've seen British ships attacked in the Red Sea. We're affected by what Iran is doing. And we're also affected, because it's the growth region of the world, by the continuing instability in the Indo-Pacific and the aggression of China towards other countries around the South China Sea and the precariousness of a democracy like Taiwan. Now, we're involved in all that. We can't step away from that. We're a big player internationally. We're in the top five at the United Nations. We're in the G7. You know, we have global responsibility as well as global ambition. We have to be ready to defend. And increasingly and finally, these conflicts are linking up. The Hamas leaders were in Moscow. Mm. North Korea is supplying weapons into Ukraine. You know, the instability in one region breeds across to the others. And we are seeing what President Bush once characterised as an axis of evil, not perhaps operating as an axis, but we now have at least three, possibly more, very hostile states who wish us in the West harm. And we have to do something about it.
Well, I was going to ask you, to what extent do you think they are cooperating? There is a live argument at the moment. There is, you know, it's difficult to know definitively, but there's a school of thought that says, okay, they're cooperating for the moment, but we're not quite clear to what extent, and maybe at some point in the future that'll change. You know, Russia and China, not natural bedfellows, but are, as you say, cooperating at the moment. Is your view that that might be true, but you can't, in the short and medium term, take the risk?
I think it's becoming true already, and it's an irony we're recording this podcast as Putin is actually, with President Xi. So, you know, it is a very active form of cooperation. They are supplying arms across to Russia. So is North Korea. So we're seeing this link up, and we're seeing Iranian missiles being used by proxies in the Middle East, and indeed being supplied into Ukraine. We're seeing Iranian drones in there. So, you know, there is a link up, and it's not a formal alliance, but it's quite clear that, you know, China too stands to gain from continuing turmoil in Eastern Europe and will be a beneficiary of it.
What sort of condition is the Western alliance in, do you think? I mean, there's a positive case to make, which is that after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the West did rally and Ukraine resisted in the most extraordinary fashion and pushed back the Russians from Kiev. It's a real struggle at the moment, you know, very difficult situation on the front line. But that Russia has had to retool its economy to become a de facto war economy. He hasn't won yet. Do you think there are some signs of hope in the way that the West has responded, or do you think that's far too complacent a view?
Well, you know, nothing would have happened without the bravery being shown in Ukraine, yeah, and the way they stood up to this straight away. Now, of course, it's true that the alliance has had to stiffen up. Sweden and Finland have joined, which undoubtedly strengthens the alliance. And those countries that have not been spending to the 2% target have now been looking at their budgets. Although it's notable that I think if you take out Britain and the United States, I think the remaining eight countries that have already met the 2% are all east of Berlin. So it's quite geographical. But if you look at the other, it's perfectly true, as you've said, that Russia has lost, you know, nearly 500,000 people, either killed or wounded. And it's taken an economic hit, although I note its growth rate this year is actually faster than Britain's.
Yeah.
But against all that, you know, it is very hard now to see how this war might end on terms that would be completely unfavourable to Putin. And unless Putin is actually defeated in Ukraine, there will always be the danger that 5 years, 7 years, 10 years' time, he'll come back. And he's made his ambition absolutely clear. And if he's left with any part of Ukraine, you can be pretty sure he'll be back for more.
To what extent should we be worried, do you think, about the re-election of President Trump? I mean, it feels as though we're heading now into a pretty frenetic next 6 months of global politics. There's going to be a UK general election at some point, quite a bit of turmoil. And then the big question, does Trump win or does Biden win re-election? Where do you stand? Do you think that people are being alarmist about this, or do you think that actually what Trump did in his first term, which was to talk tough on NATO, but then actually to increase the number of to increase the amount that, that the US spent on European resilience and deterrence? Or do you think it's a different Trump this time and we need some kind of European insurance policy?
Well, I think it's certainly going to be, if it is Trump, a better informed Trump this time. He came in last time not really expecting to win, I guess, and wasn't properly prepared. But, I think we should worry anyway about a change in administration. You know, the Biden administration has made mistakes by not being as tough as Trump was.
Yeah.
And if you look at what actually happened under Trump, if you look back at his Warsaw speech, for example, in 2017, it's fine. It's absolutely behind the importance of the alliance. His message has been, and it's been my message, you agreed 10 years ago that you would spend at 2% within 10 years. This is the 10th year, this very year, and only half the alliance has actually met it. And he's not the first American president to complain about that. You know, the 2% target was set by Obama, by the way, not by Trump. And Democrat presidents, just like Republican presidents, have long argued that American taxpayers shouldn't be having to stump up where European taxpayers failed to do so. So, you know, I think we should spend less time fretting about whether Trump gets elected, which is a matter for the American electorate, and much more time doing what we said we would do, which is, you know, spending more and really strengthening the alliance and making very sure that, the alliance is working in terms of having more deterrent effect.
In terms of 2.5%, 3%, even beyond that, what do you think the priorities are? I mean, what should it be spent on? And how do you respond to those who say, well, look, there is a lot of MOD waste. There are all sorts of procurement problems that have been recounted, you know, down the years and down the decades. How can you ensure that you get that money used as efficiently as possible?
Well, it's always been hard. These are very long-term programs. You know, I cut steel on a frigate in 2017 that I think had originally been planned by Michael Portillo, you know, 20 years before. And these long programs, you know, the design changes, new armaments, new missiles come on, new systems come on board and have to be fitted in. You know, there's something inherently inefficient about the way you have to procure very, very expensive items. Now, I'm sure they're more efficient now. The submarine program looks to be in better shape than it was. But you can see now where the gaps are. If you're accepting global responsibility, then you need a bigger navy. You simply need more ships and you need more and better paid sailors to crew them. That's, you know, abundantly clear. We have too few ships and the navy itself has got too small. When I did a defence review back in 2015, I fixed the size of the army at 82,000. It's nowhere near that at the moment. Mm. And again, if you are being asked to contribute to backfill for America, for example, to contribute troops to the eastern side of NATO, or even to send off packets of troops to various countries in Africa, to deploy more widely in the Middle East, then you need bigger forces. So the answer, I think, is you need a bigger navy, you need to beef up the army, and you do need to start planning the next generation of fighter aircraft.
How big do you think the army needs to be?
Well, I don't think there's necessarily a right number. And the biggest problem isn't actually the size of the army, it's the fact that it's under-recruited at the moment and recruitment has dropped right off since Afghanistan, since we stopped fighting. And there may be a link there. Mm. But really, we've got to do something about recruitment to both the army and the navy because they're not getting the numbers stepping forward that we need. And I note that elsewhere in Europe, step by step, even the most sort of social democrat countries are now looking at some form of conscription, optional, voluntary, taking the best or whatever. They're looking at conscription in different forms, even in France, but certainly in Scandinavia and the Baltic states. And it may be we have to go down that route.
How would that work in the UK, do you think?
Well, I think that there's quite a job to be done to explain to the public why it's necessary. The armed forces always hated national service because they thought it consumed an awful lot of cost and manpower in training people who didn't really want to be there. I think we've got to do it the other way around. We've got to reinvent a form of national service where people do want to be there, where employers will prize people who've done a year or a year and a half in some form of national service. And, you know, I think that's something that should be looked at that again. And we've certainly got to look at pay. We've got to make sure that, you know, those who do step forward are better paid, you know, better housed, and have more modern working conditions. You know, they're not sent to sea for long, long periods. They are able to keep in touch better with their families and so on.
What do you say to those who, from your old party, or from, you know, your old colleagues in government, and then potentially an incoming Labour government after the next election, when they say, well, look, there isn't the money here. There's huge demand from the NHS and on social care, and you know, every morning you wake up and there are endless demands on the on the morning news on the Today programme for money for this, money for that. Is it simply the case that this is existential, and this is the core responsibility, and actually there's at some point the public has to, there has to be some sort of, you know, levelling moment where the politicians say, listen, this is how serious the situation is, and I'm afraid other things are not going to be affordable.
Yes, and I'd like to hear politicians say that, you know, because I think really there's an acceptance now for you know, there's a market for slightly more grown-up politics about, look, we'd all like to see more money spent on different things, but turn it round. I'm sure in Ukraine they're not spending enough on social care. I'm sure in Ukraine they can't now meet their net zero target. These are all things we would love to have, but the first thing is to be able to defend your country. And that simply has to come first. And, you know, that has to come before anything else.
Let's talk a bit about technology. And it's going to be a big theme at the London Defence Conference next week, which is at King's College London at Bush House, 21st, 22nd, 23rd. And looking forward to seeing you there. But technology is going to be a big theme. And it strikes me as something very interesting is happening in the sort of interplay between politics and the fight that there's going to be if you do get a Labour government that tries to move back closer towards the European Union. And bear with me, I'm talking here about regulation. And technology seems to be, you know, it's the key in terms of not only our defence, but unlocking economic growth. Now, at the heart of all of this is a project called AUKUS, which I'm sure most of our listeners will be familiar with. That's the project to build submarines with the Australians and with the Americans, but it's also a technology deal, and that's where it becomes a sort of 10-20-year programme. Now, one of the things that I keep hearing in North America is there's a real danger here for Britain if it allows itself via a defence and security pact to get sucked into having its technology regulated alongside Brussels, essentially adopting Brussels rules on AI and the development of technology. And it strikes me as one of the most under-considered aspects of the fight that's coming. Because you can see also AUKUS as almost an alternative regulatory space, because the Japanese are going to want to join it. The Canadians have already said that they want to join it. You can see something very, very interesting emerging, a bit like what emerged out of the Manhattan Project and then with DARPA and the various schemes in the US in the 50s and 60s, which then powered the American economy in the 70s, 80s and beyond. And we seem to be moving into this world at extraordinary pace without any realization in the UK that we could get it wrong and we could end up tying ourselves to Brussels rules on tech regulation.
Yes, and I think that tension is there. It's always been there to some extent. They've always tried to wrap us up in some of the European defence programmes, for example, the very high-end programmes on aircraft and so on. But I really see enormous potential in AUKUS, and I was over in the States discussing this about a month ago. The second part of AUKUS, Pillar 2, actually means you will have a high-end technology accelerator across a whole range of these new technologies, including quantum and hypersonics and so on, which will be in the hands, and a new regulatory system with it, which will be in the hands of the democracies and not in the hands of the People's Republic of China. And that seems to be an enormous prize that we will be part of in the Indo-Pacific, and will attract other countries, as you say, like Japan, like South Korea, and who knows, maybe others as well will want to be part of that. And therefore, it is important that we, you know, we don't get sucked into some form of regulating AI that isn't in our interests. And by a happy chance, of course, we don't have to do that now because we're outside the European Union. And that may be one of the first great consequences and benefits of the vote, you know, eight years ago, that we can make that choice. And we have, to some extent, started to make that choice. You know, I think AUKUS actually will go down as one of the real achievements of the Boris Johnson government, for example,
in
seeing the potential of it, not just to get longer range, more lethal submarines built for the Indo-Pacific, but actually in getting this high-end technology accelerator and having it, you know, the way it's regulated in the hands of the democracies.
But simultaneously, you have other democracies in the European Union who make the case, very valid case, that there needs to be more defence industrial production cooperation across Europe, because of course the UK is a major player in the European defence industry, which is going to have to grow a lot over the next 10, 20 years to build this deterrence. And people say, well, hold on, Europeans, including the UK is geographically in Europe, Europeans are going to have to cooperate on making more munitions, initially to help Ukraine, but also to restock Poland and to help the Baltic states and the Swedes and the Finns. So what's the dividing line here? I can see in 5 years' time a massive fight around this, because where does sort of old-fashioned defence kit stop and then full-on technology begin? Because if Europe, for example, has to build more heavy lift capabilities, stuff to move stuff around the continent quickly, well, of course, it has technology in it, which will increasingly be AI-driven and coming from that accelerator you described. Now, I can see this fight coming between sort of Brussels, Washington, various capitals. Is there a way through it somehow, do you think?
I think it's going to be very difficult. I think that tension is there already. And I think the Europeans realise that they cannot keep relying on the United States for some of these very expensive capabilities that they've never bothered to develop jointly. Air-to-air refueling is one. Heavy lift that you mentioned is another. Establishing a proper forward market for munitions provision is another. These are things, you know, that Ukraine has really, you know, driven the European countries to, you know, to dust off their stuff. And the European Union is getting involved in it as well. And NATO, indeed, has a procurement agency. And there is going to be more closer work on that. But as you say, sooner or later, you're going to get towards the more sensitive ends of some of these technologies. And you will then get directly, you know, into the sovereignty issues. And, you know, we have that membership of Five Eyes. We have that extremely close relationship with the United States. And now we have AUKUS. So I think that tension is coming. I think you're right about that. But we are reasonably placed, I think, to have not a foot in both camps, but, you know, to keep abreast of both.
Well, I was just wondering, actually, really, if it is, as the smoke clears after Brexit, is it a return, actually, to a sort of previous British disposition of having, as you say, almost a foot in both camps? Or it opens up an interesting diplomatic role for the UK, potentially?
It does, and that's a problem. You know, it goes all the way back to de Gaulle's objection to us joining the European community in the first place. He thought we would always, you know, look across the Atlantic. And, you know, I think he's been proved right about that.
But it's going to require, isn't it, extraordinary European leadership from whether that's the Commission or the key national governments, Polish government, German government. France has its very own particular outlook, as you referenced, to, you know, the Gaullist position. But you still somehow have to find a way through that so that Europeans can make more of this stuff and arm the continent properly.
Yes, but they haven't been very successful at it so far.
No.
There's a litany of, you know, failed cooperation projects, say, between France and Germany over a common helicopter or whatever. There's a litany of these projects. You know, they haven't been spectacularly successful. For two years now, they've been promising to get ammunition sorted for Ukraine through what is called the European Peace Fund. That was delayed for a year while they argued about whether it should have include munitions being brought in from outside the European Union, from third countries. You know, there are a lot of sovereignty and political issues that have got to be resolved, you know, not by us, but inside the European continent, you know, before you have anything that, you know, remotely looks like, you know, comprising the ambition of AUKUS, for example.
Yeah. Could they potentially carve out parts of the single market? I mean, you're into then, you're into cherry-picking territory from the Brexit negotiations, or is the situation so serious that it's going to require a piece of statecraft so that leaders on both sides say, hold on, you need to devise something here, which means that, because increasingly you know how these things work, something will be developed in Sweden and then partly manufactured in Sweden and Norway, but then also in Northern Ireland or some other part of the UK or another part of the EU, it'll have four or five different components in it, or thousands of components, and then come together as a single product. Is there a way through there that you could imagine some sort of defence treaty where munitions are classified in a different way within the single market? I can hear my Remain friends saying, "Well, you know, this is exactly what they warned about with Brexit, and it's simply impossible."
Well, it may be impossible, but it'll certainly require a statecraft, and you know, we'll have to get away from the position where, you know, one block of politicians in one parliament can say we don't want that particular bit of kit used in a particular conflict, because it's got a bit of our own stuff inside it. So they're going to have to look very carefully at the different exporting rules and the way that procurement is organised, you know, across the European Union. And, you know, you can argue it's a shame we're not in there to sort of argue our corner. Now, at the moment, you know, I think they've learnt from Ukraine that, you know, the secret, the start may be more minilateral arrangements. There is, for example, a British-Polish missile agreement last Christmas, and you could see perhaps that could be extended on the eastern side of NATO to cover another country, perhaps even the western side of Ukraine, you know, to create more of a defensive shield, for example. Air defence may be one area where that sort of thing starts to be put together.
And there's a case for saying also that the Brits need to stop seeing shadows and ghosts everywhere and all of this, always thinking about this through the prism of Brexit. Because if any form of European defence cooperation was mentioned, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, at the height of the Brexit wars, then it would be seen through that prism of trying to tie Britain in on sovereignty. And I understand why people made that case at the time. I think I was concerned about it at one point in the depths of the Brexit conflict. But it does seem to be the case that that on both sides, people have moved on.
I hope they've moved on. I mean, there were anyway some European Union missions, you know, off the Horn of Africa, for example, or down in the Western Balkans, that we happily cooperated in.
Yeah.
And we did have European Union stickers on the side of our armoured vehicles. But I know, you know, some of my former friends on the right of the Conservative Party got extremely, you know, worked up about the potential of a European army and all the rest of it. But I see the future more in terms, because NATO is now so big, 30-odd countries, more in terms of minilateral arrangements. And I'll give you, if I may, you know, an example, which is the Joint Expeditionary Force, which I set up in 2014, which operates quite differently to NATO. It operates on the basis of consent. You don't have to come. You can be a member of the Joint Expeditionary Force, but not join a particular project. It's entirely by consent and voluntary, and was originally used on humanitarian missions and now is being used more and more on exercises. But if you happen in your country not to want to join a particular exercise, then you kind of don't have to. And I think and hope, you know, we'll see more kind of minilateral arrangements like that. And originally the JEF included non-EU alongside the European Union.
Yeah.
By chance it doesn't now, because both Sweden and Finland have joined. Still has Norway. But
I think it's an absolutely fascinating alliance. And, you know, I really think more should be made of it, and it has the beginnings, doesn't it, of it's a sort of northern alliance, actually. Of course it's operating in potentially in concert with NATO, and maybe even part of NATO's planning in terms of sort of northern European security.
It is.
But it's creating all manner of you know, ever closer relationships between the Finns and the Swedes and the UK, and it really could grow.
Yes, it could. And it's forgotten that it is actually a NATO framework.
Yes.
We took the lead on it and we picked it up at the Wales Summit 10 years ago, and I got it launched and away it went. And it has got the navies particularly working more closely together, which is extremely important. They're exercising, working together across those 10 countries all the time. I'd love to see, you know, Poland joining in. Poland's a Baltic navy and should be in there as well. And perhaps one day the Germans. But it proceeds simply on the basis of, you know, voluntary consent. And that's, you know, been part of its success. Now, it may be that model could be replicated elsewhere in the Eastern Mediterranean, for example, or in some aspects of air policing.
Yeah, you mentioned Poland, absolutely critical country in terms of European security. There is a large delegation coming from Poland to the London Defence Conference next week. I'm delighted to see. But I mean, Poland sees the danger very clearly, doesn't it? I mean, it has a, you know, like all countries in Europe, has a sort of divided politics at the moment. But there seems to be this very clear understanding, bringing it back to Russia and the threat environment, of how serious this is.
Yes, I was in Poland just before Christmas at a defence conference, and you know, they have very sharp political divisions. But yes, the understanding that they simply have to be spending more, and they are, and you don't get the sort of ambiguity you sometimes see in the German political space about what you need to do to defend yourself properly against Russia. And, you know, in terms of size now and political weight, Poland is becoming, you know, one of the leading countries in the European Union and is a really effective, you know, counterweight to the Franco-German alliance over in the West. So for us, certainly, and, you know, we look forward to the Polish attendees next week, you know, for us, it's a key ally as well. Mm. And that's why I was so pleased to see, you know, the agreement on missile defence between our respective companies. And, you know, I think there's a lot more scope for that.
One final question. Another thing which we're exploring, another subject area next week, is this question of national resilience. And we've actually done some opinion polling on, you know, this question of the emergency kit that people should keep in their house in case there is a cyber attack, or there is a you wake up one morning and there's been a hack of the national grid. Now, don't want to be alarmist about this, but these are real threats that the various government departments have warned about. And we'll release the findings of that. Essentially, we've asked people which elements of the national of the emergency kit they have. And I just wanted to ask you, it's not a trick question, but it's a question I've asked audiences in recently, and it produces interesting answers. So, for example, do you have a wind-up radio at home?
I don't have a wind-up radio at home. I do have a respirator, a special mask I was given, which I do have in a prominent place, and I always keep, you know, torches handy for that sort of thing, because, you know, anybody can lose power. But I think it is important, and I'm quite impressed, by the way, some of the smaller countries in Europe, not the Scandinavians and the Baltics, actually are, you know, sorting out their national resilience, embracing...
Exactly.
The private sector in terms of the local supermarket supply chains, the local pharmacies, so that we learnt under COVID that our local resilience was pretty patchy, to be honest. You know, it varied in quality and quantity across the country. And I think, you know, there's a lot more for the government to do, which they used to do in terms of actually making sure people know, you know, who's in charge in your local district, where you can go and get stuff, and the sort of stuff that you need to do for yourselves at home.
It's interesting. It's a question which provokes, it didn't provoke a smirk from you, because you understand the seriousness of the question, but people seem to see it as a bit of a relic of the 70s or the 80s or strikes in the 70s, but there is a genuine threat there. And I suppose it's that question of, you know, if the power did go off for 48 hours and there was some sort of serious hack or undersea cables were cut, it raises all sorts of questions about what happens to the underground, about sort of basic communications.
Yes.
And so there'll be a big push on that next week.
Well, I look forward to that because these, you know, more and more of our daily lives is, you know, is governed by power now. And if power is cut, you know, you're deprived of what you now regard as a necessity, and you may not be able to go to your bank.
Yeah.
People may suddenly have to finance their lives in different ways quite quickly.
That's a very good point. That is another thing which is in the emergency kit, which is to keep some cash.
Yeah.
Good advice in general anyway, always keep some cash. But Sir Michael Fallon, thank you very much for joining us on the Reaction podcast. Fascinating discussion. Look forward to seeing you next week at the London Defence Conference. You have been listening to the Reaction podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. Until next time, thank you for listening.